You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff, the podcast that celebrates those who live, love, and breathe rock and roll.
From the incredible groupies, girlfriends, and wives who went after what and who they wanted,
to the journalists, photographers, and other behind-the-scenes characters who play such an important part in rock and roll history.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine,
bringing you the best in collectibles, movies, music, wrestling, gaming, and more. Check it out at electrifiedporcupine.com.
Hey there, this is Christian Swain from the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Rock and Roll Archaeology? What's that you say? We are a podcast network dedicated to digging deep into the amazing music that exploded out of the second half of the 20th century. We believe the music, culture, and technology wove together, and it is an important story of history as, say, the Italian Renaissance or the Impressionists of Paris. We have six shows, all with a different side of this incredible time. Rock Talk with myself and host Peter Farioli. Real Rock, and that's R-E-E-L, hosted by Andy King. Vinyl Snob with the legendary Dave Whitaker. Rock and Roll Librarian with the headmistress herself, Shelley Sorensen. Deeper Digs in Rock, where I interview famous rock and roll personalities and the people who scribed the times and events. And finally, our full telling of the history of rock and roll, the Rock and Roll Archaeology Podcast, which started it all. Find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts. So let's get back to Between the Sheets of Rock and Roll with Shanti and Lynx. And Muses and Stuff.
Hi. Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm better than you at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit better. We're just saying, do you notice how people, if you're not in Canada, if you're not in Ontario, and you're a listener maybe in the States or somewhere warm, you might not know that people here sign emails or like open emails with, or like messages with, hey, hope you're staying warm, or like, stay warm. And yeah, it's like, we're not.
That's so funny because that's like the last thing I said in the Uber I took here. I said, stay warm. And then I slammed the door and, yeah.
I'm wearing two scarves. And I'm inside.
Yeah. My hands are like ice right now.
Oh, man. In February. Yeah. It's a tough one. We just have to get through it. We just, everybody, hang in there, guys.
February's my worst month. I feel just like I'm, by this time, I'm just so over it that I feel every day. But like you said, we're getting there. Every day that passes is one day closer.
Yeah. To sunshine. To skirts.
Yeah.
To bare legs.
Oh, I can't wait. I cannot wait.
You're not feeling well, and my roommate is not feeling well, and I'm fine, right knock now. On wood, yeah. You know, right now, and I'm so surprised, like, TJ hasn't been sick, and in the 4 years that I've known that guy, I've never seen him sick.
I can't even imagine. Normally, this has been like the best year for me health wise, and I'm sick right now.
No, I don't get it. And like, he loves taquitos. It's like a staple of his diet. But I think it's because he's never stressed out.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I think, do you think that getting sick has a lot to do with
for sure.
Stressed?
Yeah. I lost a little patch of my hair this year because my doctor said I was too stressed out. Like, your body does crazy things when it's stressed. It's grown back.
There's so much of it, you never know.
Yeah, luckily it's buried deep in there. Only I know that. And everyone that listens.
I wanted to tell you something. I listened to a really great podcast this week. So speaking of staying warm and cozy, a great way to do that is listen to a great podcast.
Yes.
Like Muses and stuff. But also, if you've already listened to all of our episodes and you want maybe something else to listen to, I don't listen to it every single week, but I'll always check and see what they've got going on. It's and I've talked about it before, the Rolling Stone Music Now podcast. Mm. And so their most recent episode is about Dolores from the Cranberries.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So in the episode, they talked to a few people, and then they also talked to the director of the zombie video. And he also directed Smells Like Teen Spirit and No Rain by Blind Melon.
Yeah, yeah.
So in the podcast episode, he talks about the idea and the filming and the shooting of Zombie. And he also talks about what it was like to do Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it was his first music video ever. And he talks about how, like, Kurt hated it and he hated him.
Really?
And, yeah. And, not hated, maybe didn't hate the video afterwards, but during the whole process.
Yeah,
I won't spoil it. I won't spoil it because it's so good. And then he goes on to, like, give a 30-second, like, briefing of how the No Rain video came to be.
Yeah. That's a great video, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Three iconic videos.
It made me go back and watch all three videos.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. I will check that out for sure. But right now, I got a story for you.
Oh, okay.
I've been excited about this one, especially since
the last two were.
It's been a little crazy.
Just sad. Like, they were great. They were good episodes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If I do say so myself.
Shockers. Yeah, this one's a little more innocent. I'm going to take you back to Greenwich Village in the 60s. This episode is all about Susie Rutolo. And Susie wrote a book, an incredible book called A Freewheeling Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s.
Oh, you got me at.
Right?
Yeah.
I read this book a long time ago, before I ever went to New York, and rereading it after I've been there and walked all those streets she mentions, it was like a completely different experience. And I'm so happy I got to like revisit it. And I just wish I could, you know, go back in time and actually walk on those streets with them.
Yeah.
I also read Bob Dylan's book, Chronicles, Volume 1. I'm only taking like a couple things from that in here. So the majority is Susie's. All right.
Oh, so it's spelled S-U-Z-E, but you pronounce it Susie?
Yeah.
Oh.
Her name's Suzanne. She wanted to be a little different, and she liked the way Susie looked, and that's how she picked that. She just wanted, you know, to be a little different, a little special.
Well, you must be special if you're if you're on the arm of Bob Dylan.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just, like, I'm not going to bring it up again. I'm not going to bring... You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to bring it up. If you've been listening, you know what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to talk about it again.
Bob is wonderful.
But ever since then, ever since I saw Bob...
Those magic moments. They live forever.
I've been...
There's tears in her eyes right now.
I've been like obsessed. And I'm, you know, we're like into our 30s now. We're really coming into our sexual peak. And I feel like that's played a really important role. Full disclosure.
Wow. Bob.
Okay, I'm going to take off one of these scarves now.
So Bob played a big role in Susie's life, but I would say Susie actually played a much bigger role in Bob's life.
Sorry.
It's okay. Yeah. You good? You ready for this? Go. We're going to innocent times, not where you're going.
Right. Okay.
So Susie was born in Queens, in New York, and she was what was known then as a red diaper baby, meaning that her parents were basically communists.
Oh.
Yeah. Her mom, Mary, had been born in Boston to Italian immigrants, and her dad, who went by Pete, his real name is like Gionaccio Rotolo, or I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing
that. No, it's beautiful.
Thank you. He had been born in Sicily, but he immigrated to Brooklyn in 1914, when he was around 2 years old with his family. And, both her parents really felt very strongly about fighting for workers' rights. And I believe it was after finding the writings of John Reed that her dad joined the Communist Party. And he was a struggling artist, and he usually paid the rent by working in factories, but was often fired for inciting the workers to form a union or go on strike and, you know, the usual. And Susie's mom was also into politics, and after seeing, you know, and experiencing firsthand all the injustices that were happening to immigrants at that point in time, she ended up being the editor and columnist for UNITA, which was like the American version of the Italian communist paper.
Okay.
Yeah.
I had to think about it, but yeah. I'm with you.
So their lives were very much entangled in politics, and it even played a part in her parents' engagement, because Pete apparently proposed to Susie's mom by saying, "I think I need to set up a picket line around you."
Oh, wow. That second scarf is coming off now. Just kidding. I'll actually let you know when it is.
Okay. So as it was, money was tough to come by, and during, you know, especially difficult times, Susie and her older sister, Carla, would be sent to live in separate relatives in Boston. But while they were together, they lived in Jackson Heights, which was heavily populated with immigrant families from all over Europe. And their prized possessions were really their bookshelves that were filled with books and their record player. And they didn't own a TV, and their father had built all their furniture. So they were very much like, you know, socialist activists, all about literature and, you know, growing as people. And her and Carla, they did have friends in the neighborhood, but they were basically outsiders, most likely because, you know, families around them didn't necessarily share the same beliefs. And we know that at a certain point, you know, the word communist, people sort of ran away from that if you weren't, you know, actually one. She does say that she found solace in books and poetry and making storybooks filled with characters she created from an invented world. The good memories come from the culture I lived within, being around interesting adults and different backgrounds, all kinds of music and all those books. Though we were economically working class and money was always an issue, we had a rich cultural upbringing that I relished. So when Susie was 14, her dad died very suddenly of a heart attack. Yeah. So, of course, this was a huge blow for Susie and her family. Over the next few years, her mother kind of turned to alcohol to numb the pain. And Susie, she kind of became more withdrawn at school.
That's so wild, because I just listened to a podcast today that's just like a health and wellness one. And it was about two guys who unexpectedly lost their father at 16. Wow. And then how their mother turned to drinking. Yeah. And how that really affected them.
Yeah.
So, and it was pretty wild. Yeah. How they really had to, like,
suddenly they're a parent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what Susie was going through, and it definitely affected her grades, and her teachers were very less than sympathetic. This would affect her future because she did want to go to college, but she just didn't have the grades to go.
Oh.
Yeah. But her father's death did kind of bring her and her sister together a little bit more.
Of course.
Her sister, you know, was trying to help her out of her shell, and she would bring Susie to gatherings with her college friends, and many of them also were raised or held communist beliefs. And so for the first time, she was, like, going out, meeting, you know, people her own age and meeting boys. Mm. And so, yeah, she started coming out of her shell around, you know, 14, 15. Because she didn't go to school with these people, she usually would meet them at Washington Square Park, and they would hang out in the village and, you know, check out the folk artists playing. And folk music back then was really considered, like, the music of the left, as so many songs were about fighting, you know, fascists and searching for equality and peace and things like that. So, yeah, that was the scene. And she became involved in some free outside classes that focused on politics. And for a summer, she was camp counselor at a socialist Jewish camp upstate, where she had her first boyfriend. And yes, when she heard about the march in D.C. to end segregation, she volunteered at the headquarters in Harlem, and she marched with 10,000 other students. Amazing. In D.C. Yeah, so she, you know, following in her father's footsteps and her mother's, she was always into politics.
Did you ever write children's books, or did you ever write books when you were a child?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I thought so.
So many. I also made my own magazine, which I now realize, like, I was making zines. Aww. Without realizing it. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I wish I still had them.
I have a few here.
Yeah.
I have this one book that I wrote called The Best Night of My Life. Aww. And I didn't realize until probably a few years ago that the main character was, like, my dog at the time personified.
Aww.
Yeah. And he, like, yeah, and he's like the underdog.
Aww.
But he, like, gets the girl at the end because he's so lovable. It's kind of like my,
that's so cute.
Yeah.
I think it's important to, like, to write and everything as a kid, get those ideas out.
And then when, like, computers started to become a thing, mm-hmm. like, I think we got our first computer when I was like 10 years old. And so I don't think it was my dad who was like, you could have, like, a diary on here. And then he gave me a floppy disk so that I could save. So instead of having, like, a written diary, I could type it and then put it on the floppy disk and then keep the floppy disk safe. Definitely
smart.
Don't have that anymore. But, like, thanks, Dad, for encouraging me
writing.
To do that.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. My dad was very much also, we would also go out for, like, long walks, and I would tell him stories. And, like, he still brings them up sometimes. He'll be like, remember that story you told me, like, when we were there? And
yeah, actually, another book that I have here is my dad illustrated the book. So I've got two here that are sort of, like, self-published, you know, 10 years old. And my dad did the illustrations to one of them, so.
That's so cool.
Way to go, creative dad.
Yeah. Gotta show me after.
Okay.
So during her last year of school, theater really became a refuge for her, and it really helped her overcome a lot of the shyness that was sort of left in her. She managed to make a couple of friends too, but they were now kind of heading off to college, and yeah, we know Susie just didn't have the grades to continue her education. So her sister was living in Greenwich, and it was only her and her mom in Queens, and while her mother did maintain a job, she was drinking heavily, and the effects really did weigh on Susie, and their relationship became a little strained. So she ended up moving to Harlem to live with her aunt, and she got a job as a clerk at the Book of the Month Club, which sounds just up my alley. One of her good family friends was a man named Pete Carmen. He sort of became a chaperone for her, and her mom kind of asked him to keep an eye out for her, like, but his idea of chaperoning was, like, going to Greenwich, getting her into the bars, things like that.
Yeah.
Pete Carmen would become, or maybe he was already, a journalist for the New York Mirror. So if that name sounds familiar, that's why. In the spring of 1961, Susie's mother was doing much better. And she had decided that what she needed was a change of scenery, and she wanted to move to Italy. So since Susie was still a minor, it was planned that she would go too, and she was looking forward to it. As it came closer to the time that they were leaving, she kept getting this foreboding feeling. She had a dream that made it clear, like, I shouldn't be going, but she ignored it, and the day finally came.
Uh-oh, don't ignore your intuition, yeah, right? Babies.
They were driving from New York to Boston to the passenger ship, and Susie had this another unsettling moment. She had a vision in the car. She said she could see up ahead. She could see them up ahead driving in the car. Like, she could see them on the road, and it had, like, this creepy feeling, but she ignored it again, and she ended up falling asleep. And when she woke up, there was a man over her, like, trying to get her out of the car. A woman had got the bright idea to back up and cross four lanes of the highway. And of course, like, this woman missed her exit, I guess. So she was like, yeah, I'll just back up and go across four lanes.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So neither car saw each other. So her mom ended up with a broken kneecap. They both had broken ribs and concussions. And Susie also had her right eyelid lacerated. And that, it required 30 stitches.
Ooh.
So they were really incredibly lucky to be alive. Susie later learned that because she had been asleep at the time and her body was relaxed, it actually saved her from a severe spinal cord injury.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. At the time, that type of car had no seatbelts.
No way.
Yeah. So their move never ended up happening, and it took a long recovery period. But Susie got lucky, and through friends of her sister, she ended up getting or house sitting an apartment in Greenwich Village. So after they healed and everything, and her mother was sort of healing with family, she got to move down to Greenwich. So her apartment was on Waverly Place. I can't wait to bring you to New York.
I can't wait to go.
She really took any odd job she could get to earn a living before she got work at the New York offices of CORE, which stands for Congress of Racial Equality. It was 1961, so they were just beginning to see, like, all the sit-ins and freedom rides that were happening. I'm not sure if you know much about, like, the freedom rides and everything. If anyone doesn't know, it was just, like, it's, like, another tactic that CORE was creating to desegregate public transportation and things like that. There's lots of interesting information online about that and in her book. So it is really interesting history there.
I already want to read this book.
It's so good. It's so good. So Susie's job there was, like, sending out mailings and spreading information and, like, catalogs and cataloging, like, all the donations that came in and things like that. So it was also in 1961 that Susie first met Bob.
Okay.
She calls him Bobby. I want to call him Bobby, but I don't know. It's weird. It just, he's so, like, he's such, like, a god that Bobby doesn't seem suited. So
yeah.
I'm going to call him Bob. Because
okay.
I don't know Bob.
I mean, presenter's choice.
Susie was 17 and Bobby was 20. They met at a marathon folk concert that was being held in Upper Manhattan.
So Bob Dylan was already 20 years old in 1961.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's wild.
Yeah. Susie was born in 1943, November 20th, and Bob was born May 24th, 1941. And if anyone doesn't know, I don't know how you wouldn't know, but his name was Robert Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
He had just moved to New York, like, within that year that he met Susie. So he was born in Minnesota. He's a small town guy. He comes to New York wanting to be a singer. He's starting to get shows here and there. He hasn't made a name for himself yet. People in Greenwich know about him, but the world doesn't know about him yet.
Okay.
So she had already seen him before at some of the folk clubs. And they hadn't really talked yet, though. So this day they finally officially met. And she says in her book, "We started flirting and talking backstage early in the day and didn't stop until the day was done. He was funny, engaging, intense, and persistent. These words completely describe who he was throughout the time we were together. Only the order of the words would shift depending on the mood or circumstances. If I drew a portrait of him, it would consist of words morphing into different shapes and sizes. He was not linear. He was quirky and jumpy, receptive to what was around him. As inexperienced as I was in the ways of love, I felt a strong attraction to this character. It was as if we knew each other already. We just needed time to get better acquainted. And we did so over the next 4 years."
Oh, yeah.
So I also have a quote from Bob's book, because he also mentions their first encounter.
Oh, lovely.
Yes. So he says, "Right from the start, I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was the most erotic thing I'd ever seen. She was fair-skinned and golden-haired, full-blooded Italian. The air was suddenly filled with banana leaves. We started talking and my head started to spin. She had a smile that could light up a street full of people and was extremely lively. She had a particular type of voluptuousness, a rodent sculpture come to life. She reminded me of a libertine heroine. She was just my type. Cupid's arrow had whistled by my ears before, but this time it hit me right in the heart and the weight of it dragged me overboard."
Oh my God.
Right?
Only Bob Dylan can talk about Cupid. And I'm like, yeah.
I know. So yeah, they were both like pretty much smitten right off the bat. And they began doing just like what Susie said. They began getting to know each other, and they would spend all their days and evenings in the village just wandering around, going to local clubs. They visited every art gallery, talk about philosophy, politics, poetry. Bob, all the things that we know Bob for, you know, political lyrics, and we know the poetry that inspired him. We know all these things, art, that was all Susie. He didn't know about, I mean, he knew about Woody Guthrie. He knew he wanted to be a musician and everything, but
Susie.
Yeah.
Yeah, girl.
Susie had the upbringing that he didn't have.
Right.
Yeah. So when they're going around to art galleries and things like that, it's because Susie wanted to show him a new artist. And, you know, she introduced him to like Rimbaud and Brett and all these people who greatly influenced his work later on.
That's why we do this podcast.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, he really did learn a lot from her. And it was Susie who really got him, you know, into the civil rights movement and caring about what was happening in the world and everything. I have another quote from Bob. He said, "I felt like I was in love for the first time in my life. I could feel her vibe 30 miles away, wanting her body next to mine. Outside of my music, being with her seemed to be the main point in life. Maybe we were spiritual soulmates."
Yep.
Yes. So yeah, they were really getting to know each other and trusting each other. But Susie always had this wall up. She was quite reluctant to trust him. Because we know Bob back then, he was kind of a liar. He was very secretive. He didn't want people to know about his past. And that didn't just count like media people. It was also her. He was very vague about where he came from. But she says open about anything that intrigued him. So Bob would basically weave these wild tales that were incredibly interesting, but always like contradictory to previous ones. So basically he was like constantly lying to her and everyone around. And Susie didn't really care all that much about the stories, but she did find herself hurt that like even as their relationship progressed, he really was holding back. She only found out his true last name, Zimmerman, when one night he dropped his wallet and his draft card fell out. So that kind of they had a good talk that night, and she was like, I need you to actually talk to me. Like, I don't want to date a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
And she does say that he started to open up a great deal. And once he realized also, like, that he could trust her, that she's not going to be, you know, going around telling her his secrets, he did, over time, open up. So Bob still hadn't really found his footing in New York. This was his first year here, as I said. He was couch hopping, and soon Susie would also have to give back the apartment that she was setting for. He found his first New York apartment, and that was at 161 West 4th Street. And he moved in a few months before Susie would join him, because he was 20 or 21, and she was still 17. So it was, like, illegal.
Yeah.
And they were kind of worried that Bob would get in trouble. So it was actually Dave Van Ronk who, if you've seen the movie Inside Llewyn Davis, that's, like, very, very loosely based on him. Dave Van Ronk was known as the mayor of McDougal Street. He was sort of like the Rodney.
Yeah.
He, everyone knew him. You were nobody if you weren't on his radar, you know? And he kind of became like a mentor to Bob and Susie. So yeah, he was like, maybe you should wait till she's 18. So Bob moved in, and then in a few months, Susie moved in on her, like, after her 18th. The day after her 18th birthday, just to be safe. They were like, maybe, like, wait, like, your birthday and a day.
Yeah.
Susie's mother, by the way, was also finding new love and was living in sin, as her mother was saying, with her boyfriend, whose name was Fred, and he was a humanities professor. I believe they lived in New Jersey. He was married. He was waiting for his divorce to be finalized. And once that was, her mother got married and, you know, was a lot healthier and happier, too. So,
oh, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, I wanted to add that in.
Because we never know with these stories, you know?
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
Nice. Thanks for adding that in. No it was problem. Very considerate of you.
Yeah. Just in case anyone's wondering about the poor mom.
Yeah.
She recovered from, you know, her car injuries and everything. So Susie really paints, like, this most beautiful picture of those early days living together in Greenwich. She left court and she started working in theater. Usually she would build props and sets and things like that, any kind of backstage thing. And she also would waitress between gigs, just, you know, to get money. And Bob was getting gigs and starting to build up a name for himself. They would be all night going to clubs or house parties at the Van Ronks. I should also mention that Dave had a wife named Terry Thal, and she was incredible as well. She deserves her own episode. She was not just a wife. She helped every musician in the scene. She was actually, you know, for a brief time, sort of like Bob's manager. She got him, like, all his early gigs in the city, and she did that for a lot of both the Van Ronks were, like, mentors to everyone in that scene.
Cool.
Yeah, they were really great people, and they had really great parties. So, yeah, they'd be up at their place all night, and Susie says that the Van Ronks apartment, which was 190 Waverly Place, quickly became the living room of the new generation of bohemians.
That sounds amazing.
Right?
It just reminded me of something that I did this weekend. Just speaking of, like, great parties, you know? So it's not often that we really, like, have a barn burner, you know, or that I really, like, let loose and just, yeah, I'll be on the vodka train with you tonight. Yeah. So by the time we got to this party, so it was somebody's birthday party, and they had rented out the basement of a bar, and they had, like, a huge projector screen.
Oh, nice.
With the music playing, and, like, the music videos were linked up to the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in, saw what was playing, and was like, who's controlling the music? And TJ was like, don't do it. And I was like, but where is it coming from? He's like, stop. And I was like, But can we just like request some things? And he's like, we can't. Oh. Somebody else's birthday. And I was like, okay. Next day I was like, oh my God, thank you so much for keeping me in line, because like,
it's a birthday.
It's somebody's birthday. And you know what? Like, she's from Poland. So like her picks were like very just strange, you know? And,
well, but maybe you.
Right.
That's good.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Open you up to some new things. Yeah.
Anyways, once I found the cake, I was like, that's fine. I was doing better.
I've never been on the vodka train with you.
We should.
Yeah, really. I'm surprised we haven't, actually. But yeah, so that's what Susie and Bob are doing at this time. And I had to add this because if you know Dylan's music, you'll like this little nod. She said that usually they'd end up walking home through the village at the break of dawn, mm-hmm. hearing the roosters crowing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and they would also, mm-hmm. like, go by the bakery and just really read the book. It's I want a time machine. I want to go back to Greenwich. That's where I hang out most of my time when I'm there now.
Yeah.
But just imagining it, like, in its heyday, I'm like, I can't even imagine.
I think maybe like one of the closest things you could probably get is if somebody like makes a zine of you back in Greenwich Village, and you could just like flip through it and just be like, look at
I need to
I
make
am
that
in
scene.
Yeah, you make it.
I will. So, and like we were saying, this was back in when New York City was actually like affordable for artists, and they really like they had nothing. They had their books. They had their record collection that they started to grow, and that's all they needed, you know? And since we're talking about parties, I'll mention that it was together that they both tried marijuana for the first time. And Susie says that she's certain it was the Canadian folk duo Ian and Sylvia Tyson who introduced them to pot.
Those Canadians.
Yeah. Just had to add that.
Those Canadian folk duos.
And they really did pretty much stick to booze and pot. Susie does mention that one time at a party at their house, someone slipped acid in her drink. And the experience was just absolutely terrifying. Because, of course, I mean, for the first half, you don't know what's happening to you. And then, like, once you realize, you know, you're already kind of horrified. She did say Bob was also terrified and really helped her through the night. And never after that did she ever try acid. She was like, that's not for me.
Yep.
So some of the now infamous bars and venues that Bob and all these other great artists were playing around were places like the Kettle of Fish, the Gaslight. When Bob first got to New York, I believe he played at Cafe Wa. And then, he graduated on from there. There are Gertie's Folk City and the Bitter End, and they were for more established musicians. I think you needed like a license to play there or something. So... if you were playing there, you kind of were a step up. And when the owner of Gertie's, that was like the main hangout place that they had. When he found out that Susie could draw, she became one of his regular artists that was from that scene who would do posters and flyers for upcoming shows and things like that. Yeah. And Susie also later had her drawings in Broadside, which was a folk music magazine. They would put Dylan's lyrics in the magazine, and then Susie would like draw pictures around it and stuff. She has some of those in the book too. They're really cute. You can look at it if you want. Mm-hmm. Susie shares so many great stories of seeing many folk icons of this time who were just starting their careers. Anyone who's listening has an idea. There are people like Peter, Paul, and Mary, of course, Bob and Dave Van Ronk, Odetta, Judy Collins, Bill Lee, who was Spike Lee's dad, Bruce Langhorne, Jack Elliott, John Lee Hooker, Tiny Tim. You know, she mentions a lot of people in the book, and there's some great stories there. So in September, I believe it was actually September 29th, 1961, the New York Times gave a massively rave review to Dylan. He had just performed at Gertie's, and that that review, that's when his career took off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He got a record deal with Columbia, and he began, you know, doing more performances and making more money at it. And when the recording began, Susie got to join him. She said, "I had never been in a recording studio before, and it was exhilarating. The speakers were huge, and the playback sound enveloped the studio, giving me the sensation that I was inside the music, listening to the sound from the inside out. When the album came out, I read the liner notes by Bob Shelton, and I laughed at his description of me sitting devotedly and wide-eyed through the recording session. And Bob fretting on his guitar in my time of dying with my lipstick holder. I didn't wear lipstick, and how typical of a guy to translate my reaction to being in the studio for the first time as devotion. At least he got the wide-eyed right. I watched Bob as he sang and saw his focus, his loyalty to the work at hand, the art he was making. Bob was intense, both sure and unsure of what he was doing. Afterward, he'd ask, 'What did you think? What did you think?'" So,
wow.
Yeah. I haven't mentioned it yet, but it should come as no surprise. She was most definitely a feminist before the term feminism feminist had ever become a thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was sort of like the start of her noticing that people were like, "Oh, look at the cute." They called them chicks, musicians, girlfriends in that scene. They were chicks.
Yep.
So, and yeah. So
like Bob's chick.
Yeah. This was Bob's first recorded album. And we know that the Van Ronks are their very close friends and mentors. Susie mentions that that was almost lost. And I thought I'd mention this because it's an interesting lesson that Bob had to learn.
Okay.
Dave was known in the scene to do this unbelievable version of The House of the Rising Sun, and it was so good that no other musician would even attempt to play the song anymore in New York. So Bob decided not only to do House of the Rising Sun on his first album, but to do it as like in Van Ronk's version of it. So Dave told them one day, like, "Oh, guess what? Like, I'm finally getting in the studio next week. I'm going to record my version of House of the Rising Sun." And Bob had to tell him, like, "Oh, I just did." And apparently, and rightfully, I can understand, Dave was, like, incredibly angry and hurt. And it took both Terry and Susie, like, intervening to, like, salvage that friendship. And Susie said it took an unbelievable amount of booze, food, and many games of poker with Bob losing to like mend that. But it's an interesting conversation to have, especially in the folk scene, because almost all the folk songs of that time weren't written by the people who made them famous, right?
Like, right.
That's the whole point of folk music, was to gather these old songs and sing them. So it's like, it's an interesting thing. Like, and we know throughout Bob Dylan's career, he's had that like plagiarism kind of thing held over him, but it's an interesting comment on like what is like theft and what isn't. And I guess
absolutely
they had their own rules in the scene. Like, it was an unwritten rule, you don't do that song, right? And he learned, just because it's not his song either, you know, some things are better left.
All right, so Bobby D, yeah. There's your first lesson.
Exactly.
Not your last.
Another interesting thing I learned from Susie's book was when she talked about Bob finding his folk image and just how much thought he put into his look.
Hmm.
We all kind of assume Bob just got dressed and walked out the door, but he actually took great care in choosing his outfits and what he wanted. Like, he understood, I'm creating a persona, and like, what do I want that persona to be? So their relationship's going well right now. In May of 62, Susie, Bob, and their friend Paul Clayton took a road trip to Virginia. And it was a bit of a revelation to them, even though Susie had known about, you know, and fought against segregation and things like that. This is the first time they were, you know, going into witnessing that type of America. Yeah, yeah. And seeing it. They also celebrated Bob's 21st birthday on this trip. And I believe his first album had come out maybe like a month or two before for that. So he's still not big or anything. And she has this great moment where they're with locals, and some old locals hear Bob playing and they're like, "You got it, man. Like, there's something about you." And it was like a special moment. And so Susie's mom was now married, like I said, to her husband, Fred, and they were planning a trip to Italy and France, and they invited Susie. Susie really didn't know what to do. She did want to go, but now she had this life with Bob, and she was like, I don't know. Bob told her it was her decision, but that he would prefer her not to go. And apparently he was very angry when Terry did not enforce his view that she shouldn't leave him. Susie also was kind of questioning her mom's intentions, because it's no secret that she didn't like Bob and Bob didn't like her.
Okay.
Yeah. Susie actually says he paid no homage and she paid him none. They saw through each other in some way that had nothing to do with me. So, Bob actually, in some of his later songs, he like mentions her mom, and
that's really weird,
right? In the end, Susie said, "I'm gonna go."
Oh, okay. I wasn't expecting that. Right?
So the reason she...
I mean, given the history of the episode,
I know, right? I wasn't expecting that. This was so great about Susie. There was something pulling her away, and she didn't really know what it was, but she was smart enough to you know, check that out. She wanted to figure out what was going on with her. So on June 9th in 1962, they made the voyage to France, and they spent some time there, and then they drove like through Switzerland to Italy. And Susie was going to be left in Sardinia while her mom, no, sorry. She was going to be left in Perugia while her mom and Fred went to Sardinia. So Susie had enrolled herself in a 3-month language course there.
Cool.
Yeah. But the minute Susie was alone, she kind of went into this panic. She was like, oh my God, like, I'm in this foreign country. Like, I'm all alone. My mother planned this out. She separated me. Like, what, you know? It was really overwhelming for her. And it actually took her days to get the courage to even leave her room. But slowly she started to venture out, and she would go on to, of course, make friends and everything.
So that was like probably something that she really needed to do.
Oh, absolutely. And her and Bob, they did stay in touch. I have, she does put a couple of his letters
in. I was going to say, because if she's gone for that long, because when you said she's going on a trip, I was like, okay, well, she'll be gone like a month. But it's like, oh no, she's gone for like months at a time. That's a risky thing. Oh, sorry. My radio randomly comes on at 7:47 p.m.
My goodness. All right.
It's because I got this alarm clock radio, and I was just fiddling around with it, and I just tested it once.
Do you not know how to turn it on?
No.
All right. Well, it gave me time to get Bob's letter, so.
And guess what radio station it's set to? 97.3, the Boom.
Nice.
It's the best radio station in Toronto, if you ask me.
All right. So I got two letters I'm going to read you. And I will try to read it in Bob style.
Oh, great.
So the first one I got here. Nothing much happening here, I guess. Bob Shelton is waiting for Jean. The dogs are waiting to go out. The thieves are waiting for an old lady. Kids are waiting for school. Cops is waiting to beat up on someone. Them lousy bums are waiting for money. Grove Street's waiting for Bedford Street, and the dirty are waiting to be cleaned. Everyone is waiting for cooler weather. I'm just waiting for you. Aww. Right?
Yep.
And here's another one for you. I had another recording session, you know. I sang 6 more songs. You're in 2 of them. Bob Dylan blues and Down the Highway. all you 5 and 10 cent women ain't got nothing in your heads. I got a real gal I'm loving, and I'll love her till I'm dead. So get away from my door and my window, too, right now. Anyway, you're in those two, specifically. And another one, too. I'm in the mood for you, which is about you, but I don't mention your name. I wrote a song about that statue we saw in Jefferson, in Washington, of Tom Jefferson. You're in it. So, basically, the letters...
Those are awesome.
Yeah. He definitely wrote in the way that he spoke.
Yeah, you really put my Bob, like, it's like, yeah, on yeah. level. Good.
Yeah.
Love it.
So, yeah, Susie's out there. She's trying to figure out why she's out there. She knows there is a reason. And it was while she was reading Francois Gillot's memoir, Life with Picasso. She was Picasso's muse.
Mm-hmm.
She had this revelation while she was reading it. She forgot all about Picasso, and she could really only see Bob. Their personalities were just so similar that she was really floored by this. And one of the things that really stuck out to her was how these genius men were allowed to do and act how they wanted, but the women were sidelined and expected to, like, serve when needed and give without being nurtured back.
Oh.
Right? So Susie had been experiencing this a little bit in Greenwich, and I have a quote here. In my youthful confusion, I was still struggling with permission to be. All that was offered to a musician's girlfriend in the early 60s was the role as the boyfriend's chick, a string on his guitar. And in the case of Bob's rising fame, I would be a gatekeeper, one step closer to an idol. People would want to know me just to get closer to him. My significance would be based on his greater significance. That idea did not entice.
Wow.
Yeah. And she's only, like, what, like 18 here?
Yes.
Yeah, but she's realizing, and this is before he's even hit great fame, like, this isn't really, like, that. I don't want to be just, you know, a side piece.
Well, yeah, no, like, even in our episode last week, I don't know if I said it, but definitely, you know, Carol Ann had talked about being famous by association.
Yeah.
And she didn't mind playing that role.
Yeah, so it works for some people, and
yeah.
It doesn't for others, for sure. So with this revelation, like, Susie was like, oh my God, this is what I've been feeling. I just didn't know how to put it in words. And she really wanted to, like, nurture herself and to grow as a person. And that really gave her the determination to not let this opportunity of, like, being in Europe pass her by. She enrolled in an art school. She would take long walks. She ferociously read everything she could get her hands on, like poetry. And she was making her own poetry as well. And
I'm in love with her.
Right? She's amazing. She's amazing. She was drawing a lot more. She met a lot of new people, and she began picking up the language very quick. She also began using the name Justine out there after a book she was reading, which was Lawrence Durrell's Alexandria Quartet. And to top it off, she cut her waist-length hair to a more manageable and fashionable Italian style, which was still quite long. It was, like, past her shoulders, but I guess that was a big shock. And she was, you know, trying her best to kind of explain what she was going through to Bob. I'm not really sure if he understood at that point, like, what she was going through. And when she cut her hair... He wrote her back saying, yes, maybe I wish you didn't cut your hair. It's so good. The only blonde hair that doesn't look like hay. It'll grow back though, huh? Maybe you won't cut it no more then. So.
Some men just.
Yeah. And again, that's the times, I guess. Bob's not realizing, like, hey, women are evolving.
Mm-hmm.
So. Susie really was, like, putting off going back home. She didn't want to go back to that scene. She still very much loved Bob, but she didn't want to go back to being a chick, you know? And she was really unsure of what to do. In the end, it was actually the Cuban Missile Crisis that sort of helped her figure it out. It was an intense time for the world, of course, like, watching and waiting to see how that would play out. And Bob had sent her a letter, and I have this letter. It says, sitting in the Figaro all night waiting for the world to end. I honest to God thought it was all over. Not that I gave a shit any more than the next guy. That's a lie, I guess. But it was interesting waiting for the bombs to fall and kill you, and it really seemed that way. If the world did end that night, all I wanted was to be with you. And it was impossible because you're so far away, and that's why it seems so hopeless. Wow. So, yeah. This was Susie was feeling exactly the same way. And after all that indecision and conflicted feelings, it just disappeared. And she said, I knew where I wanted to be. So after 8 months of she decided, now I'm ready to go home. So, yeah, she had an amazing 8 months where she really did grow, and very important for her. And I think that's great, too, that, you know, she didn't let fear of maybe losing a guy stop her from doing something she knew that, you know, for herself she needed to do.
Putting herself first. Exactly. Which is just, yeah, almost unheard of.
Yeah.
When you.
For sure.
Link up with a God.
Yes.
Not that, I don't know if they, if any, maybe they did know that about him back then, not at that time, but.
I think they were starting to.
They were starting to realize.
Yeah.
That. Good for her.
So when she arrived, she really couldn't wait to see her friends in the village and start working in the theater again. Bob had been on tour, I believe, so he was away for like another week. So she had planned to kind of settle in and see her friends. And she really did not expect to be greeted the way she was.
By Bob?
No, by everyone else.
Oh.
She said, when I went around to some of the clubs, I did not get a friendly reception. I was greeted with accusations that I was cold and indifferent to someone who loved me. I was not there for his heartache, as well as any battle. Oh, sorry. I was not there for Dylan when he needed me most. I jumped a line. Some deliberately sang songs he had written about his heartache, as well as any ballad that pointed a finger at a cruel lover. Bob had suffered publicly, and as a result, I was a villain, the Barbara all to his sweet William. I had been looking forward to reconnecting with people and had not expected this unwelcome home. It was as if every letter Bob had written to me and every phone call he made had been performed in a theater in front of an audience. Now I was the second act, standing alone on the stage after intermission. It was open season on my performance, and I was booed and panned while the guy in the first act had a standing ovation.
What?
Yeah. So Bob had been, you know, playing his songs in Greenwich, the songs he wrote about missing her and things like that, and everyone in the village was like, how dare how dare she leave this genius man when he needed her, you know? I'm happy to report, though, that Bob, he did not treat her like, how dare you have left me. He right away, there was no kind of readjustment period for them. They were still madly in love, and they both had experienced now so much in their time apart because, you know, Bob had done his first tour and was recording, and they really had like so much to talk about. And Susie had this newfound confidence in herself and their relationship. And while they were, while she was away, it really like, it was a great creative time for Bob, like in his music. And, she had like learned so much over there that she was now bringing home to share with him. So, yeah, they both had been, you know, incredibly productive, and a lot of Bob's feelings went into songs that we love. And yeah, actually, one of my favorite songs of Bob's came out, which was "Don't Think Twice, It's All Right."
I think that's one of a lot of people's favorite songs.
Exactly.
It is something special.
Yeah. And yeah, we know from Bob's letter, Down the Highway and Bob Dylan's Blues are kind of also about her. And yeah, he wrote Don't Think Twice, It's All Right when during that time where Susie was like, I don't know when I'm coming back, if I'm coming back. I'm kind of, you know, exploring myself out here. So even songs that weren't, you know, about her were inspired by her, as it was Susie who really pushed him to write politically relevant songs, and she even taught him about certain people or issues, like the death of Emmett Till and the ballad of Peter Amberley, a lot of songs that sort of were outtakes but are now, like, we now have them. She's the one who told him those stories or told him to like look this up. And so she's just all over those albums.
Wow.
Yeah. And in February of 63, Columbia publicist Billy James and photographer Don Hunstein came to their apartment to shoot the cover art.
Hee-hee.
So they shot some with Bob in the apartment before someone, she can't remember, suggested that Susie get in the photos. She felt really awkward and shy with it, but the photographer, she said, was really great, and she kind of eventually felt at ease. And, of course, there were some great shots of Bob playing to her done in the apartment, but then Don suggested that they all go outside, and it was freezing out, but Bob picked his suede coat for, you know, style reasons, and Susie did the same. She had this beautiful green coat that she'd bought in Italy, but because it was so freezing out, she had like five layers on underneath, and she said that I felt like an Italian sausage. So yeah, they walked up and down Jones Street with Bleecker Street at their backs, and Susie took a break to warm up, and some solo shots of Bob walking and everything were taken. And when the cover art was finally chosen by the Columbia execs, Bob had nothing to do with the choosing of it. Susie was really surprised to see that they'd chosen the photo with her.
Oh, I love it.
Isn't it the best?
It's the best.
And you can like really see their
love. We're looking at it right now.
Yeah. It's such a great, such an iconic.
Yeah.
So she was really happy with it. And Bob apparently was very, very happy with it. So it all worked out. And Bob was actually set to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show to promote the album, but CBS told him that he couldn't perform the song he had chosen. He had chosen one called Talkin' John Birch Paranoid Blues, and it was sort of like a controversial subject matter. And he said, if you don't let me play this, I'm not going to play at all. So Bob never did go on Sullivan. And Columbia actually cut the song completely off the album. Bob agreed because he got to choose a couple newer songs that he'd written to like put in its place. And that album officially came out in May, I believe. So we know that Bob was kind of like very closed off and lied about, you know, where he came from and everything like that. But when Susie was in Italy, he was really opening up to her in his letters, and now she really did feel like, I know the real him and he knows the real me. And since arriving in New York, Bob had been pretty much cut off from his family, but his family actually got in touch after reading an article about their son in a magazine or a newspaper. The newspaper said that Alan Grossman was his manager, so they called Alan Grossman and was like, can you get us in touch with our son? And so Bob did call home, and in April, Bob invited his parents to come to New York, and they did get to see him perform, and Bob and Susie went to dinner with his parents after, and she says they were really nice and reserved, and she was just really happy that, you know, they were at this step in their relationship where it's like, Bob, trust me, and I'm meeting his parents. And so they were very serious, you know. And she also mentions around this time they were traveling a lot. She would go with him to random events and things. They spent a week at the Columbia Records convention that was in Puerto Rico, and there's some stories there. And she also mentions coming to Toronto with him.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, just like a throwaway thing there, but I thought that was cool. And so they were traveling around a lot together. And so, of course, she was with him for the Newport Festival as well. So I guess now's a good time to bring up Joan Baez.
Yeah, let's do that.
So by now, Joan was like a superstar. She was known as the Queen of Folk. She was much, much bigger than Dylan. And they did kind of hang on the same circles, but I don't think Joan was like that impressed with him until she heard some of his songs and was like, oh my God, like you have a genius in you. And so.
And her name is Susie.
Yes. she really did become kind of fascinated with Bob and his music. And they'd played together before at Monterey. Joan invited Bob to come up and play with her. Bob really never considered himself a protest singer, and Joan, like, did. And she sort of ended up introducing him to a lot of, like, political activists, and was really determined to spread Bob's songs around because she really believed, like, this is the voice of our generation. This is the music that needs to be heard. So she was, like, all about Bob. Even though she was also with someone else, she definitely did have a massive crush on Bob. And in New York, they actually opened and closed the show Newport. Did I say New York or Newport? In Newport, they opened and closed the show together. If you're wondering if they had, like, a physical relationship at this time.
I am wondering.
Joan has said, "We didn't need to make love. The music seemed enough at the time."
Yeah.
So people were noticing this, though. And Susie said, "It was inevitable that he and Baez would create electricity. I got a few sidelong glances whenever they sang together." So the rumor mill is really kind of beginning, and there's gossip about Joan and Dylan, you know, spending time together. They were definitely, Joan invited him out on, like, her tour after that, so they were definitely spending, like, a lot of time together. I also read another book when I was doing this episode called Positively Fourth Street. It focuses on, like, Joan and Dylan and Richard Farina and one of Joan's sisters. She had two other sisters who were big in the folk scene. There's comments in that about how people would notice Joan kind of, like, caressing Bob's hair. And one time they walked backstage and, like, they were slow dancing together back there and stuff. So they were definitely, like, getting physical.
Yeah.
And Bob actually ended up going to the West Coast for a while. Like. Yeah. He went to the West Coast and actually lived with Joan and her family for a short time. So this was definitely, like, a rough point for Susie, mostly because she hated her private life being, you know, the number one topic of gossip. And she decided what was best for her was to move out of their apartment, which she did. And she moved in with her sister in an apartment on Avenue B. She was working in theater and waitressing here and there, and she also enrolled at a school for visual arts and began to, like, meet new people. And she was trying to sort of, like, develop her own life. She wanted to be her own person, you know. Her and Bob did continue their relationship, though, but she felt a lot less pressure when they weren't living together and could come together when they chose to.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
I can understand that.
And, again, she's young. She doesn't want to be tied down. Her sister, Carla, had been a big fan of Bob's when they first started the relationship. But after the Joan stuff, she was, like, not a fan of Bob anymore. And Susie really says, like, I was caught in the whirlpool of indecision that is tortured young love. And we sure tortured and young loved each other to distraction. I mentioned earlier that Bob meant, like, has kind of basically talked shit about her parent or her mother and her sister before. If you listen to the song Ballad in Plain D, I think the, like, last line in the song is, like, for her parasite sister, I have no respect, or something. Oof. Like that. So it was pretty heated between Susie's family and Bob. Shortly after she moved to Avenue B, Susie actually did find out she was pregnant. It was a very tough decision. In the end, they decided to have an abortion.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I had no idea about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. And at that point, it was illegal. So.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Yeah. To make that decision, it was, like, a greater decision than, you know, it is today in some respects, because it was, like, I need to find the right doctor. I need to make sure that, like, something doesn't go wrong. And so it was a stressful time, but they did their research and they found the right person and they decided this is needs to be done. By around October, I guess Bob had come back from Joan's place in L.A. He had a concert at Carnegie Hall. And his parents came back for it, and they were so proud of Bob, and they got interviewed by Newsweek, and they were just so happy. But that Newsweek article was incredibly harsh, and it took the tone of Bob. That was when the world found out Bob Dylan is Robert Zimmerman, and he's not what he appears to be. And they really kind of made it sound like he was an imposter. Like, look at this middle class upbringing. Like, you think he's like this poor poet, you know, prophet. And so unfortunately, like, his parents suddenly went from like being just talking about their son to have like told his secret, basically. And he didn't blame his parents, though. He understood, but they felt so awful that they possibly harmed their son's career. And of course, Bob was just furious about the article coming out at all. But the Carnegie Hall performance, not only for Bob, was also a big shift for Susie. We do know it had been coming for a while, though. Bob's fame was, you know, growing bigger and bigger. And for the first time, it was at this show that fans were like waiting there and chased them after. And she says, "I remember being very frightened by the energy of the crowd. They literally charged the limo, pounding the roof, slapping the windows, yelling to get Bob's attention. This was truly the beginning of his future. Bobby has become Dylan."
Yeah.
So that was like a huge kind of turning point. I should mention also, I forgot to when I started this, Susie's book is not linear. So there may be things that I'm saying that didn't happen precisely in this order. I tried to kind of make it as linear as I could.
Okay.
And they do kind of get on and off in their relationship. And because she's not specific about that, I sort of had to like make a timeline for that.
Oh, nice.
So I'm pretty sure that like this is 99%. It all happened. It's just, you know, one thing might have happened a little earlier and one thing might have happened later.
Oh, that's really cool. Thanks.
It's a really great book. And I like the way that I like that it's nonlinear because it's very, you know, Dylan, and it made sense in the book. So because Bob's fame is growing and we already know Susie has this feeling of, you know, I'm not a chick. I am a woman of my own importance. And she had a couple of interesting conversations around this time. The first was with Pete Seeger after the Carnegie Hall concert. She says, "He said I was a muse to an exceptional songwriter and artist. He talked about his philosophy of life. He talked about his wife, Toshi. He talked about many things, but above all, he wanted to tell me how special Bob was and how I was an important role in that. He wanted to acknowledge my role since I, too, was a rare soul. I felt honored by his call and warmed by his words. His thoughtfulness in making the call and his regard of how I might be feeling in this whirlwind time of rising fame for Bob was generous and genuinely helpful. Even though he saw in me the role as the woman behind the man, I was not offended." But she had kind of the opposite conversation with Alan Lomax, who was another kind of folk rock scene guy in that time. He had told her that he thought she was exceptional because, in so many words, "I stood by the poet, the genius. I unselfishly tended to his needs and desires. I put him first. I was a rare girl for these times." So by that, she was like incredibly offensive. And yeah, she was like, no. So Susie had, you know, we know she'd experienced this before she went to Italy, but because Bob had gone, you know, even greater heights by now, it was an even greater problem. She said there was an attitude toward musicians' girlfriends, chicks, as we were called, or old lady, if a wife, that I couldn't tolerate. The word chick made me feel as if I weren't a whole being. I was a possession to this person, Bob, who was the center of attention. That was supposed to be my validation. I was still forming myself, but I did know I wasn't a musician, nor was I a musician's chick. And you could bet the neck of a Gibson I had no desire to graduate to old lady.
Neck of a Gibson. Yeah. Haven't heard that one before.
So good. I chafed at the notion of devoting my young self to serving anybody since I was still curious and life questioning. Because I was with my boyfriend didn't mean I had to walk a few paces behind, picking up his tossed candy wrappers, but I didn't know where to put that frustration. This was before Women's Lib in the 70s, when many of these issues were articulated. I resented not being able to wander off by myself and sit in a cafe to draw, read or write without guys, or the way guys could without being hit on. And forget about going to a movie alone. A girl at the movies by herself meant she was fair game, asking for trouble, and she usually got it. So, yeah, she's really feeling the frustration of the time, and fuck, I can't even imagine. Like, it's bad enough now.
Yeah.
In the 60s, especially when you don't have, you know, an outlet to vocalize this yet. You know, it's great that Women's Lib, when you read her book, you kind of, it's like, it makes sense that Women's Lib happened immediately after this time, you know, like it was about time.
Yeah, it's just like fair game. It's like referring to like men. It's like just animals.
Yeah, and it's so true. Like that woman, you know, you're a wife, so now you're an old lady. Like, that is so insulting.
But then again, it's like, but if you're not somebody's old lady by this certain point, then you're, what is it, like out to pasture?
Spinster.
Out to pasture, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's like you can never win as a woman.
Yeah.
So, yeah. She does say that Bob, like, never saw her as just a chick or less than him. He knew her importance.
There's a lot of
other
people putting that on there, yeah.
But yeah, it still doesn't make up for how like infuriating that must have been for her. So even with Susie now living like separate from Bob, he would always be at her place. And if he wasn't in the city, he was constantly phoning her. And for some women, that would be like amazing. But for Susie, who was kind of desperately at this point trying, you know, to separate herself from that. It's interesting that you... this relates also to Carol's thing, because she says that, like, I needed to separate myself from the trickle-down fame.
Yeah.
Right? Because there was Bob, and then all of Bob's close friends, suddenly, like, all of them were famous, and she just did not want it. So there was always, like, the love between them was strong, but the fame and all the negativity that came with that was just, it was too much for her. Like, she never signed up for that. She never wanted it. And she said that one night they were like walking together silently along East 57th, and they were heading towards our apartment. And she says, he was inside himself. I felt uneasy, trapped. I thought I would suffocate. I looked at him and I said I had to go. I felt my life was at stake. With a resigned sadness, he gestured toward me with his hand. It wasn't an offer to take it. I saw it as an acceptance of the inevitable, and I echoed the gesture. It was a sacrificial move so we could both move on and live as we needed to. I turned and walked away without looking back.
Oh, my God.
She didn't look back then, but especially when you love each other that much, breaking up isn't always the easiest of things. So Bob would still call, and, you know, they were still kind of hanging out here and there, and they would kind of be on and off for the next little while. But it kind of grew more in a friendship way, because she didn't want that commitment, right? She wanted to be her own person. She didn't want to jump back on the ride.
So do you think that then, because of that, that he always held her in this really high regard? Like, because they didn't ever have the opportunity to let the relationship sour? And
it's interesting, yeah. In Bob's book, too, he doesn't really...
What if they would have had that child? What if they would have stayed together? Would he, like...
Bob just says this in his book. The alliance between Susie and me didn't turn out exactly to be a holiday in the woods. Eventually, fate flagged it down, and it came to a full stop. It had to end. She took one turn in the road and I took another. So that's sort of how he kind of summarizes the end of that. They did remain like friends, though. When he was recording Highway 61 Revisited, Susie attended the recording sessions, and she talks about how Alan Grossman got her to hold down some organ keys for some songs and stuff. She can't remember which song, but she was like, you know, not playing, but she was there, you know, participating. And she was also present for that iconic Forest Hills concert in 65 when Dylan went electric. And of course, in her book, she talks about, you know, all that change. And yeah, Susie really doesn't specify like if they are just friends or more than friends at this time. But we also know he was on and off with Joan Baez at this time.
Yeah.
And I think he met his wife, his first wife, Sarah, also in this period. So she might even be involved. I don't know, like, personally things about their relationship. That would be an interesting one to look into.
Yeah.
But
yeah. You can bet the neck of a Gibson that would be interesting to look into.
I think after Susie, though, he definitely chose his women well, in regards to like not choosing another woman who wants to be out there doing her own thing. And he, because I don't really know about his other wives except that they were like very behind the scenes, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know many public things about them. So yeah, she also mentions, which I thought was interesting, that Albert Grossman called her to ask for her passport stuff in the 65, because Bob was going to England. Mm-hmm. And I guess Bob wanted her to come. But she said that was another cue for her to sever the tie, because yeah, she didn't want to get caught up in that again. It would have been interesting if she went. I think that was when he met Marianne and, you know, did that documentary and everything. So yeah. She also mentions going to a party at Jerry Schatzberg Loft with Dylan, Bobby Newirth, and Edie Sedgwick, who we also know was a muse to Bob for at least one song. That was Leopard Print Pillbox Hat. Blah, blah, blah.
Say that one five times.
Right? And she does talk about like how Warhol was pestering him all night and that, like...
I bet.
Yeah. Bob treated him like shit, apparently. And so yeah, even though it was Susie who really like did the deciding of like, I don't want to be in this relationship anymore, and kind of pushed him away, that doesn't mean that she wasn't suffering for it. She talks a little bit about having like a breakdown after their split, and she did have a very rough time of it. I think she even like went to live with her mother for a bit in New Jersey just to like regroup and everything. Speaking in hindsight, Susie said, "We loved each other very much, and when it ended, it was mutual heartbreak. His way was to do what he wished and let things sort themselves out without making decisions that might hurt. Yet that hurt more. He avoided responsibility. I didn't make it easy for him either. My mounting confusion and insecurities made me mistrust everything he said. I was difficult and unreasonable. But he tried hard to reach me, but I was too far gone to hear him. I made him crazy. But I knew I was not suited for this life. I could never be the woman behind the great man. I didn't have the discipline for that kind of sacrifice."
Whoa.
Yeah. And it is interesting to have an episode of a muse who knows that and doesn't want, especially since a lot of them, you know, happily accept that sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting. Susie talks about the mix of emotions when his next few albums came out, since they're like full of stories about her and how difficult it really was for her to have all that in the public, especially since she had no control over how people would, you know, read into all the lyrics and everything. Gradually, though, she did learn to let go and accept it all. She said, "I listened to Dylan's songs spread over his early albums, and I remember how it was. It's like reading a diary, a private smile because no one knows about that. A laugh because that was really funny, or a tear because that was so hard. Our time together fed his work. I know I influenced him. We marked each other's lives profoundly. He once told me that he couldn't have written certain songs if he hadn't known me. But that doesn't necessarily mean a particular song. It means I served as muse during our time together, and I don't mind claiming that. I'm not going to end it with their relationship ending, because Susie was her own woman,
mm-hmm.
and she had some incredible things happen to her in the 60s that didn't even involve Dylan at all.
Okay.
So read the book, obviously. Read the book, especially to get even more of this. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about her involvement in politics. She was in the second wave of students to challenge the travel ban to Cuba. And she was the only woman in the group, I believe. She talks of the 2 months they spent there and all they did, including spending time with Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and, you know, other leaders. And
wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And when she was back in the States, she enrolled at the Harvard Extension School for theater production and Italian language classes. And I think she lived with this man, Albert Marr, who was in the group that went to Cuba for a while. Before she returned to New York. And, of course, she traveled more of Europe. And her book ends in the mid-60s, but I did find some facts online. She married a man named Enzo Bartolucci. I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce the last name. In 1967. And Enzo is a film editor, and he also worked at the UN. So I'm sure there were a lot of politics and... They had a son named Luca, and apparently Luca's like a guitarist and a guitar maker in New York right now.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And Susie continued with her theater work and her artwork, and she published some stuff, and she was still very much into politics. She protested at the 2004 Republican convention, and she was involved also in the memorial event for Dave Van Ronk, who passed away in 2002. She made an appearance in Scorsese's No Direction Home, his documentary. And I think that was the first time she ever actually talked publicly about her and Dylan. So, yeah, that happened in the 60s. It took her like 40 years before she was ready to, you know, open up.
I've never seen No Direction Home. Is it?
It's good.
Good. Yeah.
In 2008, that's when her book came out. In 2011, on February 25th, she passed away, unfortunately, from lung cancer, and she was 67.
Oh, that's young.
So young, yeah. But I wonder what her son is up to, making his guitars in New York and continuing the political
activism. Well, we've got a trip to New York to make together.
Yeah.
Maybe we could do a little bit of...
I didn't mention this as well, but I want to throw it in there. Bob Dylan does great artwork, as we know. He first got involved doing art because Susie came home from Italy and was drawing, and he decided, like, I'll pick up a, you know, pen and paper too. And so he never would have, you know, thought of art if it weren't for her. So she influenced him in like every way you can imagine.
Every way.
Oh. And it's really nice to see that Bob does give her credit.
Yeah.
In his books, he talks about it, and he's talked about it in articles and, you know, before. He knows that, you know, she helped shape who he is and what his career became. Absolutely.
You can bet the neck of a Gibson. Gibson, she did. Yeah, that's amazing. That was so good. Okay. It's such a, what a change of pace and direction from the last two episodes. And it was, I wasn't expecting that at all, actually. Yeah. So that was
not
a really
a
nice story.
On his guitar, like
she wasn't.
Said. No.
It wasn't just the chick.
I wish she'd written another book about, you know, her life after the 60s, because I'm sure she had so many other fascinating, awesome things happen to her. But, yeah. And anyone who's interested in folk music or Greenwich Village in the 60s, her book, there's so much there. She talks about all the people around at that time and there are plenty more stories of her and Bob in here. So I highly, highly recommend it. I really loved it.
A Freewheeling Time, a memoir of Greenwich Village in the 60s.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks so much, Lynx.
Of course.
All right. And thank you, everybody, for listening. If you guys wouldn't mind heading over to iTunes.
Yeah.
Give us a little message and show us some love.
Valentine's is coming up.
Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give us a little bit of love. Just a little lovey love, baby. Thank you for listening.
Yeah.
As always, you can find us on Instagram, Amuses and Stuff Podcast, same thing with Facebook, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks.
Bye.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.